The most remarkable feature of man's future is its flexibility. It is determined by his attitudes rather than by his acts. The cornerstone on which all things are based is man's concept of himself. He acts as he does and has the experiences that he does because his concept of himself is what it is. Had he a different concept of self, he would act differently. A change of concept of self automatically alters his future, and a change in any term of his future series of experiences reciprocally alters his concept of self. Man's assumptions, which he regards as insignificant, produce effects that are considerable. Therefore, man should revise his estimate of an assumption and recognize its creative power. The future, although prepared in every detail in advance, has several outcomes. At every moment of our lives, we have before us the choice of which of several futures we will choose. There are two actual outlooks on the world possessed by everyone, a natural focus and a spiritual focus. We may differentiate them as ordinary waking consciousness, governed by our senses, and a controlled imagination, governed by desire. What is mental and subjective to the natural man is concrete and objective to the spiritual man. The habit of seeing only that which our senses permit renders us totally blind to what otherwise we could see. To cultivate the faculty of seeing the invisible, we should often deliberately disentangle our minds from the evidence of the senses and focus our attention on an invisible state, mentally feeling it and sensing it until it has all the distinctness of reality. Earnest, concentrated thought focused in a particular direction shuts out other sensations and causes them to disappear. We have but to concentrate on the state desired in order to see it. The habit of withdrawing attention from the region of sensation and concentrating it on the invisible develops our spiritual outlook and enables us to penetrate beyond the world of sense and to see that which is invisible. A little practice will convince us that we can, by controlling our imagination, reshape our future in harmony with our desire. Desire is the mainspring of action. No matter what we do, we follow the desire which at the moment dominates our minds. When we break a habit, our desire to break it is greater than our desire to continue in the habit. The desires which impel us to action are those that hold our attention. A desire is but an awareness of something we lack or need to make our life more enjoyable. Desires always have some personal gain in view. The greater the anticipated gain, the more intense is the desire. There is no absolutely unselfish desire. Where there is nothing to gain, there is no desire, and consequently no action. The key to progress in life and to the fulfillment of dreams lies in ready obedience to its voice. To desire a state is to have it. Man, by assuming the feeling of his wish fulfilled, and then living and acting on this conviction, alters the future in harmony with his assumption. As soon as man assumes the feeling of his wish fulfilled, his four-dimensional self finds ways for the attainment of this end, discovers methods for its realization. The first step in changing the future is desire. That is, define your objective. Know definitely what you want. Secondly, construct an event which you believe you would encounter following the fulfillment of your desire. An event which implies fulfillment of your desire, something that will have the action of self predominant. Then, with eyelids closed and your attention focused on the action you intend to experience, in imagination, mentally feel yourself right into the proposed action, imagining all the while that you are actually performing the action here and now. You must always participate in the imaginary action, not merely stand back and look on, but you must feel that you are actually performing the action so that the imaginary sensation is real to you. It is important always to remember that the proposed action must be one which follows the fulfillment of your desire. You must feel yourself into the action until it has all the vividness and distinctness of reality. Make elsewhere here and the future now. The future event is a reality now in a dimensionally larger world. And, oddly enough, now, in a dimensionally larger world, is equivalent to here in the ordinary three-dimensional space of everyday life. The difference between feeling yourself in action, here and now, and visualizing yourself in action as though you were on a motion picture screen is the difference between success and failure. The difference will be appreciated if you will now visualize yourself climbing a ladder. Then, with eyelids closed, imagine that a ladder is right in front of you and feel you are actually climbing it. Desire, physical immobility bordering on sleep, an imaginary action in which self feelingly predominates, here and now, are not only important factors in altering the future, but they are essential conditions in consciously projecting the spiritual self. To condense the idea which is to be the object of our meditation into a single act, and to reenact it over and over again until it has the feeling of reality. Otherwise, the attention will wander off along an associational track, and hosts of associated images will be presented to our attention. In a few seconds, they will lead us hundreds of miles away from our objective in point of space, and years away in point of time. If we decide to climb a particular flight of stairs because that is the likely event to follow the realization of our desire, then we must restrict the action to climbing that particular flight of stairs. Should our attention wander off, we must bring it back to its task of climbing that flight of stairs and keep on doing so until the imaginary action has all the solidity and distinctness of reality. The idea must be maintained in the field of presentation without any sensible effort on our part. We must, with a minimum of effort, permeate the mind with the feeling of the wish fulfilled. Feed the mind with premises, that is, assertions presumed to be true, because assumptions, though unreal to the senses, if persisted in until they have the feeling of reality, will harden into facts. Man can prove the existence of a dimensionally larger world simply by focusing his attention on an invisible state and imagining that he sees and feels it. If he remains concentrated in this state, his present environment will pass away, and he will awaken in a dimensionally larger world where the object of his contemplation will be seen as a concrete, objective reality. Men believe in the reality of the external world because they do not know how to focus and condense their powers to penetrate its thin crust. To remove the veil of the senses, we do not employ great effort. The objective world vanishes by turning our attention away from it. We have only to concentrate on the state desired in order to mentally see it. But to give it reality so that it will become an objective fact, we must focus attention upon the invisible state until it has the feeling of reality. When, through concentrated attention, our desire appears to possess the distinctness and feeling of reality, we have given it the right to become a visible, concrete fact. At the end of your meditation, when you awake from your controlled waking dream, you feel as though you had returned from a great distance. The visible world which you had shut out returns to consciousness, and by its very presence informs you that you have been self-deceived into believing that the object of your contemplation was real. But if you know that consciousness is the one and only reality, you will remain faithful to your vision. And by this sustained mental attitude, confirm your gift of reality and prove that you have the power to give reality to your desires that they may become visible, concrete facts. Define your ideal and concentrate your attention upon the idea of identifying yourself with your ideal. Assume the feeling of being it, the feeling that would be yours were you already the embodiment of your ideal. Then live and act upon this conviction. This assumption, though denied by the senses, if persisted in, will become fact. You will know when you have succeeded in fixing the desired state in consciousness by simply looking mentally at the people you know. If you see them as you formerly saw them, you have not changed your concept of self. For all changes of concepts of self result in a changed relationship to your world. In your meditation, allow others to see you as they would see you were this new concept of self a concrete fact. You always seem to others an embodiment of the ideal you inspire. Therefore, in meditation, when you contemplate others, you must be seen by them mentally as you would be seen by them physically were your concept of self an objective fact. That is, in meditation, you imagine that they see you expressing that which you desire to be. If you assume that you are what you want to be, your desire is fulfilled, and in fulfillment, all longing is neutralized. You cannot continue desiring what you have already realized. Your desire is not something you labor to fulfill. It is recognizing something you already possess. It is assuming the feeling of being that which you desire to be. Believing and being are one. The conceiver and his conception are one, therefore that which you conceive yourself to be can never be so far off as even to be near, for nearness implies separation. Being is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. If you assume that you are what you want to be, then you will see others as they are related to your assumption. If, however, it is the good of others that you desire, then, in meditation, you must represent them to yourself as already being that which you desire them to be. It is through desire that you rise above your present sphere, and the road from longing to fulfillment is shortened as you experience in imagination what you would experience in the flesh, were you already the embodiment of the ideal you desire to be. A dream is nothing more than uncontrolled four-dimensional thinking, or the rearrangement of both past and future sensory impressions. When we have learned to control the movements of our attention in the four-dimensional world, we shall be able to consciously create circumstances in the three-dimensional world. We learn this control through the waking dream, where our attention can be maintained without effort. For attention minus effort is indispensable to changing the future. We can, in a controlled waking dream, consciously construct an event which we desire to experience in the three-dimensional world. The sensory impressions we use to construct our waking dream are present realities displaced in time, or the four-dimensional world. All that we do in constructing the waking dream is to select from the vast array of sensory impressions those which, when they are properly arranged, imply that we have realized our desire. With the dream clearly defined, we relax and induce a state of consciousness akin to sleep, a state which, although bordering on sleep, leaves us in conscious control of the movements of our attention. We experience in imagination what we would experience in reality were this waking dream an objective fact. It is important always to remember that the only thing which occupies the mind during the waking dream is the waking dream, the predetermined action which implies the fulfillment of our desire. How the waking dream becomes physical fact is not our concern. Let me again lay the foundation of changing the future, which is nothing more than a controlled waking dream. 1. Define your objective. Know definitely what you want. 2. Construct an event which you believe you will encounter following the fulfillment of your desire, something which will have the action of self-predominant, an event which implies the fulfillment of your desire. 3. Immobilize the physical body and induce a state of consciousness akin to sleep. Then, mentally feel yourself right into the proposed action, imagining all the while that you are actually performing the action here and now, so that you experience in imagination what you would experience in the flesh, were you now to realize your goal. Instead of learning my craft in schools where attending courses and seminars is considered a substitute for self-acquired knowledge, my schooling was devoted almost exclusively to the power of imagination. I sat for hours imagining myself to be other than that which my reason and my senses dictated, until the imagined states were vivid as reality. Man's imagination is the man himself, and the world as imagination sees it is the real world. In meditation, when the brain grows luminous, I find my imagination endowed with the magnetic power to attract to me whatsoever I desire. Desire is the power imagination uses to fashion life about me as I fashion it within myself. First desiring and then imagining that we are experiencing that which we desire to experience, we can mold the future in harmony with our desire. In dream, we are usually the servant of our vision rather than its master, but the internal fantasy of dream can be turned into an external reality. In dream, as in meditation, we slip from this world into a dimensionally larger world. It is in this fully conscious state, when we are in control of the direction of thought, that we call things that are not seen as though they were. In this state, we call things by wishing and assuming the feeling of our wish fulfilled. Unlike the world of three dimensions, where there is an interval between our assumption and its fulfillment, in the dimensionally larger world, there is an immediate realization of our assumption. The external reality instantly mirrors our assumption. We can, by the power of imagination, mold our world in harmony with our desire. No man needs help to direct him in the application of this law of consciousness. I am is the self-definition of the Absolute, the root out of which everything grows. What is your answer to the eternal question, who am I? Your answer determines the part you play in the world's drama. Your answer, that is, your concept of self, need not conform to the external reality to which it relates. If I do not believe that I am already that which I desire to be, then I remain as I am and die in my present concept of self. There is no power outside of the consciousness of man to resurrect and make alive that which man desires to experience. That man who is accustomed to call up at will whatever image he pleases will be, by virtue of the power of his imagination, master of his fate. It is our conception of ourselves which frees or constrains us, though it may use material agencies to achieve its purpose. Because life molds the outer world to reflect the inner arrangement of our minds, there is no way of bringing about the outer perfection we seek other than by the transformation of ourselves. There can be no outer change until there is first an inner change. As within, so without. Everything we do, unaccompanied by a change of consciousness, is but futile readjustment of surfaces. However we toil or struggle, we can receive no more than our assumptions affirm. If we would become as emotionally aroused over our ideals as we become over our dislikes, we would ascend to the plane of our ideal as easily as we now descend to the level of our hates. Love and hate have a magical transforming power, and we grow through their exercise into the likeness of what we contemplate. By intensity of hatred, we create in ourselves the character we imagine in our enemies. Qualities die for want of attention, so the unlovely states might best be rubbed out by imagining beauty for ashes and joy for mourning, rather than by direct attacks on the state from which we would be free. There is nothing to change but our concept of self. As soon as we succeed in transforming self, our world will dissolve and reshape itself in harmony with that which our change affirms. The undisciplined mind finds it difficult to assume a state which is denied by the senses. Assume that you are that which you want to be. Experience in imagination what you would experience in the flesh were you already that which you want to be. Remain faithful to your assumption so that you define yourself as that which you have assumed. Things have no life if they are severed from their roots, and our consciousness, our I am-ness, is the root of all that springs in our world.
When these chapters have been mastered, you will know how to own your own mind. First of all, find out what you would like most to do. Then lay out plans to begin doing it, and begin right where you are to carry out your plans. Recognize now and forever that whatever you get from life will depend upon what you give to life. The combined wisdom and genius of mankind cannot conceive of an argument against the liberty of thought. Think before acting, not afterward. Those who discover their dormant creative vision and put it to work will make jobs for themselves, just as others before them have done. The others will go on down the dusty road to failure in the midst of an abundance of opportunities, just as this class always has done. Two things are essential for the unfolding and use of creative vision. One is a willingness to work, and the other is a definite motive sufficient to inspire one to go the extra mile with the right mental attitude. Search as you may, but you cannot find anything to take the place of these. Work and motive, by themselves, are not sufficient guarantees of enduring success. Ideas are the beginning of all achievements. They are the seedlings of all progress. There is no such reality as something for nothing, or something for less than its true value. After a man has attracted favorable attention to himself by the habit of going the extra mile, he is then in a position to adopt a definite major purpose and to begin expressing it in action through a definite plan. Obsessional desire is the state of mind which serves to clear the mind of fear and doubt and self-imposed limitations, thereby opening the way for that state of mind known as faith. When you adopt a definite major purpose, you must focus all your emotional feeling on the object of that purpose, in a spirit of absolute belief in its attainment. Let your daily slogan be, "You can do it if you believe you can." By some strange power with which no one is familiar, the subconscious mind acts directly and immediately upon the thoughts which are based upon absolute belief. All great leaders are able believers. There are certain basic requirements of success in which one must believe in order to succeed. Some of them are belief in infinite intelligence, belief in oneself, belief in one's chosen associates, belief in right over wrong, that right will prevail if one persists in believing in right, belief in the proven laws and facts of science, belief in the power of the mind to connect itself with infinite intelligence and become, therefore, irresistible. The greatest power available to mankind is an intangible power, neither the nature nor the source of which is understood. It is man's only irresistible power. Stated in one sentence, it is the capacity of men to believe in something. Just that alone, without any modifying definitions, the simple, clearly demonstrable power of belief. The power that has worked miracles down through the ages. Not all the scientific knowledge known to mankind can cope with this intangible form of power. It has nothing in common with logic or reason, and it overrides both at will. It is a law unto itself, and the strangest feature of this power is that it can be appropriated and used by the humblest person the same as by the most educated and renowned. Go as far back as you please, and you will discover that the strong men, the great men, the successful men, have been those who believed in something. The world belongs to men who believe. It always has, and it always will. In organizing your mind power, be sure to include in your plans a definite program of belief in the things you wish to become real. Let your belief be positive. Believe in something, not against something, remembering meanwhile that belief is contagious, that belief in one thing tends to open the way for belief in many things, while unbelief works in the same manner. No one can rise above mediocrity unless he believes in his own ability to become and to remain self-determining. A disorganized mind can never be free. The mind develops and becomes strong only through action. Even belief is useless unless it is followed by some sort of action appropriate to its nature and purpose. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeoning of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Yes, one may become the captain of his soul if he will take possession of his own mind, organize it, and express it in terms of organized endeavor behind definiteness of purpose. Men may lose all their worldly possessions, including sound health. They may be cheated, imposed upon, maligned, and slandered by others, or they may be unjustly thrown into prison and deprived of their physical liberty. But they still may think their own thoughts and use their own mind power without the consent of any other person. Whatever man desires, he may acquire with the aid of his power of thought, provided he will organize his thoughts and apply his thought power in a spirit of belief in his own ability to make it serve his needs. Thought, applied in a spirit of belief, unlocks prison doors and gives men their freedom. It develops body resistance and frees men from disease where everything else fails. It supplants poverty with opulence. It dispels fear, worry, and discouragement and fills their places with hope, faith, and peace of mind. It works with the speed of lightning, requiring nothing but a determined will to put it into action. Opinions are the freest thing in the world, and most of them are worth exactly what they cost. Nothing. Accurate thinkers permit no one to do their thinking for them. They ascertain the sources of such facts as they desire and make wise use of the sources for their guidance. Learn to be cautious and to use your own judgment, no matter who is trying to influence you. Before being influenced too far by your emotions, give your reasoning faculty, your head, a chance to pass judgment on the business at hand. The head is always more dependable than the emotions, the heart. The person who forgets this generally lives to regret his neglect. Let your mind be always an eternal question mark, not in the sense of being a confirmed skeptic who believes in nothing, but as a cautious person who wishes to be accurate in his thinking. Question everything and everyone until you satisfy yourself that you are dealing with facts. Do this quietly in the silence of your own mind. the emotions of love and sex. Either of these emotions may easily override facts and render the faculty of reason useless. Don't let them do it. Hatred, anger, jealousy, fear, revenge, greed, vanity, egotism, procrastination, and the desire for something for nothing. These emotions frequently distort facts. You've been given three important fact-finding departments of the mind, namely, 1, the power of will, 2, the faculty of reason, and 3, the faculty of conscience. These departments of the mind become strong and reliable only through discipline, training, and use. Give them a chance to pass on everything you wish to accept as facts. Form the habit of relying upon their decisions. Be very careful about accepting as facts anything that originates in these three areas of the mind. 1, the five senses, 2, the emotions, and 3, the memory. All three of these sources are faulty, and they require the strictest of self-discipline before they become dependable. Gain control of your mind, force it to feed upon thoughts of your own choosing, and you will then be in reality the master of your fate, the captain of your soul. Repetition of thought creates thought habits in the mind, which cause the mind to go right on working on an idea without one's conscious effort. Definiteness of purpose, backed with a form of persistence that assumes the proportions of an obsession, is the greatest of all stimulants of both the synthetic and the creative forms of imagination. The mind of man is provided with a power which forces the subconscious mind to accept and to act upon obsessional desires that are definitely planned. Every adversity brings with it the seed of an equivalent benefit. A man generally finds whatever he is looking for if he gives his desire obsessional proportions. To get more from life, one must give more. This is a truism from which no man can escape. Nature fixed it in all natural laws. Therefore, it is not a man-made rule. Apparently, the subconscious concerns itself first with those thoughts which have become habits, and especially if the thoughts have been strongly emotionalized by a deep and burning desire for their realization. Desire, based on a definite motive, is the beginning of all voluntary thought action associated with individual achievement. The presence in the mind of an intense desire tends to stimulate the faculty of imagination with the purpose of creating ways and means of attaining the object of the desire. If the desire is persistently held in the mind through repetition of thought, it is picked up by the subconscious section of the mind and automatically carried out to its logical conclusion by the most practical means available. Thoughts are things, said a great philosopher, and it is significant that thought is one of the few things an individual may control completely. It may not be literally true that thoughts are things, but it is true that thoughts create things, and the things they create are striking duplicates of the thoughts out of which they are fashioned. Thought magnetizes one's entire physical body and attracts to one the outward physical things which harmonize. Observe that the memory, the five senses, and the emotions require constant self-discipline, that they are not reliable without the strictest of discipline, and that they need highly organized attention to bring them under control. This control is obtained by the exercise of the power of will through the adoption of voluntary habits. Through the application of self-discipline, thought can be influenced, controlled, and directed through transmutation toward a desired end by the development of voluntary habits suitable for the attainment of any given end. All of man's achievements begin in the form of thought, organized into plans, aims, and purposes, and expressed in terms of action. Both the subconscious and the conscious sections of the mind work in response to habits, adjusting themselves to whatever habits the individual may form, whether the habits are voluntary or involuntary. When habits are once formed, the mind proceeds to carry them out automatically unless they are modified by other and stronger habits. The five senses are so untrustworthy that they can be easily deceived, especially when they function under emotional excitement, such as fear, love, sex, or in fact any of the other emotions, without the balancing influence of the faculty of reason. We must face the fact that most of that which we express as our individual belief is but a reflection of the belief or pretended belief of those nearest us. If there is one tragedy greater than all others that can overtake an individual, it is that of being robbed at birth of his God-given right to take possession of his own mind and use it in his own way. The mind absorbs any idea to which it is repeatedly submitted, whether the idea be sound or unsound, right or wrong. We are here dealing with the real power behind human achievements, the power that is responsible, through its misuse, for much human misery, the power that brings success or failure, according to the way it is applied. Let us assume that we are actually taking a physical picture of the power of thought, using the mind as the sensitive plate of the camera and controlled habit as the lens through which any desired object may be photographed. The plate of the camera will register any object reflected upon it through the lens. It does not pick and choose, but registers everything that is cast upon it, whether good or bad. To make a clear picture, the lens must be properly focused, and the object to be photographed must be flooded with the proper amount of light, all of which depends upon the skill of the person operating the camera. The picture he gets will be in exact proportion to his skill in controlling all these factors. Now, let me shift the scene from the camera to the human brain, and see how perfectly the two resemble one another in the manner of their operation. The individual chooses the subject he wishes to register in the cells of his brain, the brain serving as the plate of the camera. He calls the subject chosen a definite major purpose. He wants the brain to pick up a clear picture of the object of that purpose, register it, and turn it over to his subconscious mind for translation into its physical reality. Therefore, he proceeds, through the principle of controlled habit, to place in his conscious mind a picture of that which he wants. Day by day, he recreates that picture through controlled habit, recognizing, as the skilled thinker does, that the mental impulse of thought through which he is painting the picture in his brain must be given the right amount of time, through repeated exposures, to register, and it must also be accompanied by the proper proportion of light, emotional feeling, to enable the brain to pick up a clear outline of the thought. These principles will not work merely by one's having read and understood them. They must be put into action. The action must be persisted in until it becomes fixed habit. I am repeating this in many different ways because to overlook it will mean defeat. Without action, there will be no controlled habits. Without controlled habits, there will be no dependable registration in the brain of the picture of that which one desires. There will be nothing which the subconscious mind can take over and act upon. The faculty of the will is the boss of all other departments of the mind. It can make habits and it can unmake them. It can choose aims and purposes, and it can change them. It can countermand any desire of the emotions and set aside any decision of the faculty of reason. The faculty of the will is the tool with which one paints a clear picture of that which one desires, and it does this by presenting that picture in the conscious mind repeatedly. This repetition of desire or purpose followed by appropriate action in carrying out the desire or purpose, is the method by which controlled habit is formed. If the faculty of the will is sufficiently determined, as it is when one's definite major purpose is an obsession, it can and does call into action every other region of the mind. Organized thought is a mixture of the power of will and the power of the emotions, properly balanced and directed to the attainment of definite ends. Disorganized thought is that which is inspired by the emotions, without the modifying influence of the will, that is, emotion without control. That sort of thought is without value. It may be, and it usually is, very dangerous. It always is dangerous if it is not modified by the faculty of reason. The faculty of willpower is the medium that may be used to balance the relationship between the emotions and the faculty of reason. Your emotions are not always reliable, and generally they influence you to reach decisions regardless of facts. You will know when a habit has been properly established by your own state of mind and by the results you get from it. When the habit has been properly developed, you will experience a feeling of continuous enthusiasm in connection with your plans. This enthusiasm will drive you during your every conscious moment. It will even continue driving you through your subconscious mind while you sleep. Work will no longer be a drudge. It will be a pleasure in which you will engage as eagerly as you eat your meals when hungry. Moreover, things will begin to happen outside your own mind that will give you courage. Your imagination will become keener and more active. You can work long hours without becoming fatigued. You will experience better health than you ever had before. The dark glasses of despair you have been wearing will change their color, and you will see the whole world around you through crystal clear glasses of hope and faith. For you will have changed the entire vibration of your being. This is no idle promise. I know it will be realized by you. Defeat may overtake you, as it overtakes everyone. But you will use it as a challenge to greater effort because you will have discovered that organized thought is an irresistible force capable of making stepping stones out of stumbling blocks. How, may I ask, could anyone be permanently defeated who has acquired the ability to transmute every emotion, every feeling, every fear, and every worry into a constructive, positive driving force for the attainment of definite ends? And this is precisely what organized thought enables one to do. First step, the adoption of a definite major purpose. Second step, the creation of a practical plan for attaining the purpose. Third step, a mastermind alliance with others whose experience, education, skill, and influence may be needed. Fourth step, immediate action in carrying out the plan adopted. Observe that all four steps are well within the possibility of easy control by anyone, but nothing will happen unless all four steps are taken and persistently carried out to their logical conclusion. This calls for controlled habit. It calls for constant application of the necessary habits until the object desired has been attained. How inconsistent it is that the only thing over which a human being has complete control is the one thing which most people make the least attempt to control. The inconsistency becomes all the more astounding when one recognizes the fact that the power of organized thought offers the solution to all of one's problems and nothing else does.
If we really want to live, we'd better start at once to try. If we don't, it doesn't matter. But we'd better start to die. The choice is simple. Between now and the inevitable end of our days, we can choose either to live or to die. Biological life is an automatic process, as long as we take care of our needs of the body. But to live in the sense the poet means, it is by no means something that will happen by itself. If we don't take charge of its direction, our life will be controlled by the outside to serve the purpose of some other agency. Biologically programmed instincts will use it to replicate the genetic material we carry. The culture will make sure that we use it to propagate its values and institutions. Other people will try to make as much of our energy as possible to further their own agenda. All of this without regard to how any of this will affect us. We cannot expect anyone to help us live. We must discover how to do it by ourselves. There is no hope in the past. There is no solution to be found in the present. Nor will we be better off by jumping ahead into an imaginary future. The only path to finding out what life is about is a patient, slow attempt to make sense of the realities of the past and the possibilities of the future as they can be understood in the present. Life will mean what we experience from morning to night, 7 days a week. For about 70 years, if we're lucky. For even longer, if we are very fortunate. What this life will amount to is in part determined by the chemical processes in our body, by the biological interaction among organs, by the tiny electrical currents jumping between the synapses of the brain, and by the organization of information that the culture imposes on our mind. But the actual quality of life, and what we do, and how we feel about it, will be determined by our thoughts and emotions, by the interpretations we give to chemical, biological, and social processes. How can each person create an excellent life? If we look out of a window in winter, we might see millions of identical snowflakes cavorting by. But if we took a magnifying glass and looked at the flakes separately, we would soon discover that they were not identical. In fact, that each had a shape that no other flake duplicated exactly. The same is true of human beings. If everything was determined by the common human condition, by social and cultural categories and by chance, it would be useless to reflect on ways to make one's life excellent. Fortunately, there is enough room for personal initiative and choice to make a real difference. And those who believe this are the ones with the best chance to break free from the grip of fate. To live means to experience through doing, feeling, thinking. Experience takes place in time, so time is the ultimate scarce resource we have. Over the years, the content of experience will determine the quality of life. Therefore, one of the most essential decisions any of us can make is about how one's time is allocated or invested. Of course, how we invest time is not our decision alone to make. Nevertheless, there is room for personal choices, and control over time is to a certain extent in our hands. Even in the most oppressive decades of the Industrial Revolution, when workers slaved away for more than 80 hours a week, in mines and factories, there were some who spent their few precious free hours in literary pursuits or political action instead of following the majority into the pubs. Rarely do we feel the serenity that comes when heart, will, and mind are on the same page. To control attention means to control experience, and therefore the quality of life. How much stress we experience depends more on how well we control attention than on what happens to us. The effect of physical pain, of a monetary loss, depends on how much attention we pay to it, how much room we allow for it in consciousness. The more psychic energy we invest in a painful event, the more real it becomes, and the more entropy it introduces in consciousness. To deny, repress, or misinterpret such events is no solution either, because the information will keep smoldering in the recesses of the mind. It is better to look suffering straight in the eye, acknowledge and respect its presence, and then get busy as soon as possible, focusing on things we choose to focus on. All emotions share a basic duality, which is, they are either positive and attractive, or they are negative and repulsive. The evolution of self-reflective consciousness has allowed our race to toy with feelings, to fake or manipulate feelings in ways that no other animal can. The songs, dances, masks of our ancestors evoked dread and awe, joy and intoxication. Horror movies, drugs, and music do the same thing now. Everything we do is ultimately aimed at experiencing happiness. We don't really want wealth or health or fame as such. We want these things because we hope that they will make us happy. But happiness we seek not because it will get us something else, but for its own sake. In fact, if one wants to improve the quality of everyday life, happiness may be the wrong place to start. The quality of life does not depend on happiness alone, but also on what one does to be happy. If one fails to develop goals that give meaning to one's existence, if one does not use the mind to its fullest, then good feelings fulfill just a fraction of the potential we possess. Without dreams, without risks, only a trivial semblance of living can be achieved. Emotions refer to the internal states of consciousness. Negative emotions, like sadness, fear, anxiety, or boredom, produce psychic entropy in the mind. That is, a state in which we cannot use attention effectively to deal with external tasks, because we need it to restore an inner subjective order. Positive emotions, like happiness, strength, or alertness, are states of psychic negentropy, because we don't need attention to ruminate and feel sorry for ourselves, and psychic energy can flow freely into whatever thought or task we choose to invest it in. When we choose to invest attention in a given task, we say that we have formed an intention, or set a goal for ourselves. How long and how intensely we stick by our goal is a function of motivation. Intentions, goals, and motivations are also manifestations of psychic negentropy. They focus psychic energy, establish priorities, and thus create order in consciousness. Without them, mental processes become random, and feelings tend to deteriorate rapidly. It is the goals that we pursue that will shape and determine the kind of self that we are to become. The normal condition of the mind is one of informational disorder. Random thoughts chase one another, instead of lining up in logical, causal sequences. Unless one learns to concentrate and is able to invest the effort, thoughts will scatter without reaching any conclusion. Usually, the more difficult a mental task, the harder it is to concentrate on it. But when a person likes what he does and is motivated to do it, focusing the mind becomes effortless, even when the objective difficulties are great. By learning to concentrate, a person acquires control over psychic energy, the basic fuel upon which all thinking depends. Imagine, for instance, that you are skiing down a slope and your full attention is focused on the movements of the body. There is no room in your awareness for conflicts or contradictions. You know that a distracting thought or emotion might get you buried face down in the snow. The run is so perfect that all you want is for it to last forever, to immerse yourself completely in the experience. If skiing does not mean much to you, substitute your favorite activity for this vignette. It could be singing in a choir, programming a computer, dancing, playing bridge, reading a good book. Or this complete immersion in the activity may occur in a social interaction, as when good friends talk with each other, or when a mother plays with her baby. What is common to such moments is that consciousness is full of experiences, and that these experiences are in harmony with each other. In moments such as these, what we feel, what we wish, and what we think are in harmony. The metaphor of flow is one that many people have used to describe the sense of effortless action they feel in moments that stand out as the best in their lives. Athletes refer to it as being in the zone, religious mystics as being in ecstasy, artists and musicians as aesthetic rapture. Athletes, mystics, and artists do very different things when they reach flow, yet their descriptions of the experience are remarkably similar. Flow tends to occur when a person faces a clear set of goals that require appropriate responses. It is easy to enter flow in games such as chess, tennis, or poker because they have goals and rules for action that make it possible for the player to act without questioning what should be done and how. For the duration of the game, the player lives in a self-contained universe where everything is black and white. The same clarity of goals is present if you perform a religious ritual, play a musical piece, write a computer program, climb a mountain, or perform surgery. Activities that induce flow could be called flow activities because they make it more likely for the experience to occur. In contrast to normal life, flow activities allow a person to focus on goals that are clear and compatible. Another characteristic of flow activities is that they provide immediate feedback. They make it clear how well you are doing. After each move of a game, you can tell whether you have improved your position or not. Flow tends to occur when a person's skills are fully involved in overcoming a challenge that is just about manageable. If challenges are too high, one gets frustrated, then worried, and eventually anxious. If challenges are too low relative to one's skills, one gets relaxed, then bored. If both challenges and skills are perceived to be low, one gets to feel apathetic. But when high challenges are matched with high skills, then the deep involvement that sets flow apart from ordinary life is likely to occur. A typical day is full of anxiety and boredom. Flow experiences provide the flashes of intense living against this dull background. When goals are clear and challenges and skills are in balance, attention becomes ordered and fully invested. Because of the total demand on psychic energy, a person in flow is completely focused. There is no space in consciousness for distracting thoughts or irrelevant feelings. Self-consciousness disappears, yet one feels stronger than usual. A sense of time is distorted, Hours seem to pass by in minutes. When a person's entire being is stretched into full functioning of body and mind, whatever one does becomes worth doing for its own sake. It is the full involvement of flow, rather than happiness, that makes for excellence in life. When we are in flow, we are not happy, because to experience happiness, we must focus on our inner states, and that would take away attention from the task at hand. If a rock climber takes time out to feel happy while negotiating a difficult move, he might fall to the bottom of the mountain. The surgeon cannot afford to feel happy during a demanding operation, or a musician playing a challenging score. Only after the task is completed do we have the leisure to look back on what has happened, and then we are flooded with gratitude for the excellence of that experience. But one can be happy without experiencing flow. We can be happy experiencing the passive pleasure of a rested body, a warm sunshine, or the contentment of a serene relationship. These are also moments to treasure, but this kind of happiness is very vulnerable and dependent on favorable external circumstances. The happiness that follows flow is of our own making, and it leads to increasing complexity and growth in consciousness. We can also see why flow leads to personal growth. In arousal, a person feels mentally focused, active, and involved, but not very strong, cheerful, or in control. How can one return to the more enjoyable flow state? The answer is obvious: by learning new skills. The flow experience acts as a magnet for learning, that is, for developing new levels of challenges and skills. It takes energy to achieve optimal experiences, and all too often, we are unable or unwilling to put out the initial effort. Flow is generally reported when a person is doing his or her favorite activity. A life filled with complex flow activities is more worth living than one spent consuming passive entertainment. To be totally absorbed in what you are doing, and to enjoy it so much that you don't want to be doing anything else? I don't see how people survive if they don't experience something like that. When we are able to confront life with such involvement and enthusiasm, we can be said to have achieved an autotelic personality. Autotelic is a word composed of two Greek roots, auto, meaning self, and telos, meaning goal. An autotelic activity is one we do for its own sake because to experience it is the main goal. An autotelic person needs few material possessions and little entertainment, comfort, power, or fame because so much of what he or she does is already rewarding. Because such persons experience a flow in work, in family life, when interacting with people, when eating, and even when alone with nothing to do, they are less dependent on the external rewards that keep others motivated to go on with a life composed of dull and meaningless routines. They are more autonomous and independent because they cannot be as easily manipulated with threats or rewards from the outside. At the same time, they are more involved with everything around them because they are fully immersed in the current of life. If there is one quality that distinguishes autotelic individuals, it is that their psychic energy seems inexhaustible. Even though they have no greater attentional capacity than anyone else, they pay more attention to what happens around them, they notice more, and they are willing to invest more attention in things for their own sake, without expecting an immediate return. Most of us hoard attention carefully. We dole it out only for serious things, for things that matter. We only get interested in whatever will promote our welfare. The objects most worthy of our psychic energy are ourselves and the people and things that will give us some material or emotional advantage. The result is that we don't have much attention left over to participate in the world on its own terms. To be surprised, to learn new things, to empathize, or to grow beyond the limits set by our self-centeredness. Autotelic persons are less concerned with themselves and therefore have more free psychic energy to experience life with. If one has failed to develop curiosity and interest in the early years, it is a good idea to acquire them now, before it is too late to improve the quality of life. Many people will say that this advice is useless to them, because they already have so many demands on their time that they absolutely cannot afford to do anything new or interesting. Time stress has become one of the most popular complaints of the day, but more often than not, it is an excuse for not taking control of our lives. How many of the things that we do are really necessary? How many of the demands could be reduced if we put some energy into prioritizing, organizing, and streamlining the routines that now fritter away our attention? It is true that if we let time run through our fingers, we will soon have none left. Not so much in order to achieve wealth and security in some distant future, but in order to enjoy life in the here and now. Time is what one must find in order to develop interest and curiosity to enjoy life for its own sake. The other equally important resource is the ability to control psychic energy. Instead of waiting for an external stimulus or challenge to grab our attention, we must learn to concentrate it more or less at will. If you are interested in something, you will focus on it. And if you focus attention on anything, it is likely that you will become interested in it. Work has severe drawbacks, but its lack is worse. It is possible to learn to like solitude, but it does not come easily. If one is an artist, scientist, or writer, or if one has a hobby or a rich inner life, then being alone is not only enjoyable but necessary. Relatively few individuals, however, master the mental tools that will make this possible. Whether we like solitude or not, however, in our times we must be able to put up with some of it. It's difficult to learn math or practice piano or program a computer or figure out the purpose of one's life when other people are around. The concentration required to order thoughts in consciousness is easily interrupted by an extraneous word, by the necessity to pay attention to another person. As long as we can presume that the others will share our basic goals and will behave predictably within certain limits, their presence adds a great deal of spice to the quality of life. Romance and sex provide some of the best moments of the day, but for most people these activities are rather rare, so they fail to make much of a difference in the overall quality of life unless they are embedded in a context of an enduring relationship that provides emotional and intellectual rewards as well. Variety and frequency of sexual encounters have taken precedence over the depth and intensity of the relationship in which they are embedded. A force that could result in some of the deepest and most intimate joys of life is taken over and manipulated by outside interests. As with other aspects of life, the important thing is to decide for oneself, to realize what is at stake, and what are the interests that try to control our sexuality for their own ends. It helps to realize how vulnerable we are in this respect. It is a very universal condition. What counts is how we wish to order our lives and what part we wish sexuality to play in it. And the less we depend on it for material benefits, the more we can enjoy its potential for emotional rewards. The effects of family relationships on the quality of life are so extensive that volumes could be written about it. The only way to take over the ownership of life is by learning to direct psychic energy in line with our own intentions. The quality of life is much improved if we learn to love what we have to do. The problem is that people also learn to love things that are destructive to themselves and to others. Enjoying what one does is not sufficient reason for doing it. Flow is a source of psychic energy in that it focuses attention and motivates action. Like other forms of energy, it is neutral. It can be used for constructive or destructive purposes. Fire can be used to warm us up on a cold night, or it can be used to burn down the house. The same is true of electricity or nuclear energy. Thus, in creating a good life, it is not enough to strive for enjoyable goals, but also to choose goals that will reduce the sum total of entropy in the world. These goals cannot be justified only in terms of our lives here and now, because if the only effects of our actions were the ones we could observe in this life, common sense would dictate that we get as much pleasure and material advantage as we can, even if we must be ruthless in the process. There are enough hints about how the universe functions to know that what kind of actions support the increase of complexity and order, and what kind lead toward destruction. In order to experience flow, it helps to have clear goals. Not because it is achieving the goals that is necessarily important, but because without a goal, it is difficult to concentrate and avoid distractions. The simple way of improving the quality of life is to take ownership of one's actions. The same ability to transform a tragic situation into at least a tolerable one is shown by victims of terrorists who survive solitary confinement or prisons and concentration camps. Those who survive are able to ignore selectively the external conditions and to redirect their attention to an inner life that is real only to themselves. It is easier to do so if you know poetry, mathematics, or some other system of symbols that allows you to concentrate and do mental work without any visible material props. These examples suggest what one needs to learn to control attention. In principle, any skill or discipline one can master on one's own will serve. Meditation and prayer, if one is so inclined. Exercise, aerobics, martial arts, for those who prefer concentrating on physical skills. Any specialization or expertise that one finds enjoyable and where one can improve one's knowledge over time. The important thing, however, is the attitude toward these disciplines. If one prays in order to be holy, or exercises to develop strong pectoral muscles, or learns to be knowledgeable, then a great deal of the benefit is lost. The important thing is to enjoy the activity for its own sake, and to know that what matters is not the result, but the control one is acquiring over one's attention. Normally, attention is directed by genetic instructions, social conventions, and habits we learned as children. Most of what we experience will have been programmed for us. We learn what is supposed to be worth living and dying for. Through the years, our experience will follow the script written by biology and culture. The accident of birth puts a person in a slot that greatly determines what sorts of experiences his or her life will consist of. Unfortunately, there is no justice, nor any rhyme or reason in one person being born into a starving community, perhaps even with a congenital physical defect, while another starts life with good looks, good health, and a large bank account. So while the main parameters of life are fixed, and no person can avoid resting, eating, interacting, and doing at least some work, humanity is divided into social categories that determine to a large extent the specific content of experience. When and where we happen to be born defines a single coordinate of existence that no one else shares. Thus, each of us is responsible for one particular point in space and time in which our body and mind forms a link within the total network of existence. For, whereas it is true that Who we are is determined by genetic instructions and social interactions. It is also true that having invented the concept of freedom, we can make choices that will determine the future shape of the network of which we are a part. Whether we like it or not, our lives will leave a mark on the universe. One cannot lead a life that is truly excellent without feeling that one belongs to something greater and more permanent than oneself. It would be so much easier if we were responsible only for ourselves. Unfortunately, things don't work that way. An active responsibility for the rest of humankind and for the world of which we are a part is a necessary ingredient of a good life. The real challenge, however, is to reduce entropy in one's surroundings without increasing it in one's consciousness. Act always as if the future of the universe depended on what you did, while laughing at yourself for thinking that whatever you do makes any difference. It is this serious playfulness that makes it possible to be both engaged and carefree at the same time. Helping to maintain order in the universe becomes its own reward, regardless of consequences. Then it is possible to find joy even when fighting a losing battle in the good cause. The danger is that one's entire psychic energy will go towards satisfying the needs of the imaginary entity we have ourselves created. This might not be too bad if the self we bring into being is a reasonable entity. But children who are abused may grow up constructing a hopeless or vindictive image of self. Children who are indulged without being loved may create narcissistic selves. A self may grow to be insatiable or have a completely exaggerated idea of its importance. Persons who own such a distorted self nevertheless feel compelled to satisfy its needs. If they think they need more power or money or love or adventure, they will do everything to satisfy that need even beyond what is good for them in the long run. In such cases, a person's psychic energy, directed by an ill-conceived ego, is likely to cause entropy in the environment as well as within consciousness. For each of us, the chief obstacle to a good life is oneself. Yet if we learn to live with it, the self can become a friend, a helper, a rock upon which to build a fulfilling life. We all have the opportunity to use ambition, the need to be loved, even aggressiveness, in constructive ways, without being carried away by them. Once we realize what our demons are, we need not fear them any longer. Instead of taking them seriously, we can smile with compassion at the arrogance of these fruits of our imagination. We don't have to feed their ravenous hunger except on our own terms, when to do so helps us achieve something worthwhile. What we feel, what we wish, and what we think are in harmony.
The baby is born and we hold in our hands a miraculous living creature whose potential is unknown. What will enter that astonishing brain? And from those ingredients, what kind of life will this child fashion? Ideas are the most important things on earth. And each of us has his own or her own idea factory. It comes as standard equipment at birth. The big brain of the Homo sapiens. Ideas, The great ideas that move us to be better and greater than we now are the deeply embedded anchors that will hold us in place when the great storms of life crash about us. We're by no means immune to mistakes, but we understand that they're a natural part of growth and reaching into the unknown. We all have basic and inherent genetic differences. Regardless of the genetic equipment we've been handed, the goals we set and invariably reach when they're truly our goals and not the goals of a parent or acquaintance meet our desires perfectly. Our daydreams or habitual visions are often the way our inherent genetic mix is put together, and those dreams and visions are trying to tell us which way to go. They're often the projection of our inner voice, and that inner voice is based on very sound judgment about our true inherent capacities. The thing we must put aside in order to fulfill our unique possibilities is conformity. We need to recognize that there are ways in which we must not conform, and we need to recognize the fact that the tendency to conform to the standards of others without question is insidious. There's a human tendency, no doubt acquired and strengthened in childhood, to believe that whatever people in significant numbers are doing must be correct, or so many of them wouldn't be doing it. The great majority of people seldom enjoy the best of anything. The best is never the most popular. Now, I mention these things to establish the importance of questioning the things we do. Do we do them because they're what everybody else is doing? Or because we've come to the conclusion that they're best for us and our personal journey into meaning? Whatever the majority of people are doing, under any given circumstance, if you will do the exact opposite, you will probably never make another mistake as long as you live. Using our intuition along with our intelligence as a guide can be the best way to produce really super ideas. How it works is a mystery. That it does work, we've all demonstrated at times during our lives. When a person knows where he or she is going and is engaged in getting there, the most amazing coincidences begin to take place. When we know where we're going and occupied on our journey, it seems as though all the forces, whatever they are, come to our aid. We're helped along by invisible as well as visible sources. This is not to say that we encounter nothing but smooth sailing. On the contrary, there's that door, of course, which is like a members-only sign outside an exclusive club. It seems to exist to prevent all but the 100%ers from gaining entrance to the winner's circle. Perseverance. Dogged, unflagging, repeatedly rejected perseverance is the answer, of course. And when we've set our heart and mind on something that is so important to us, we can generate that kind of persistence. The first step of the successful goal person is commitment. The person who's 100% committed to the achievement of a goal is quite willing to take whatever intermediate steps are necessary. The bridges are burned. There's no escape route on which to come tiptoeing back when things get rough. Commitment. 100%. When that happens, the goal is as good as accomplished, and you'll have fun and great experiences on the road to its achievement. In fact, the goal itself may come as an anticlimax, demanding the immediate setting of a new goal. As we work to bring a difficult long-range goal into reality, we gradually grow into the kind of people to whom such a goal is a natural thing. That's because before we can do something, we must be something. We actually become what we think about. And the key to it all is that it is each one of us who must do the thinking, and each of us has his own governor. success in the long run depends on endurance and perseverance. Examine your life, your wants, your dreams, your daydreams, your visions, and look for a consistent key, a way in which you'd like to see yourself doing some particular thing as a form of work or service. A consistent daydream is often the projection of our inner intelligence trying to tell us what we should be doing. If it's the right work for you, chances are you found yourself fooling around with it in your spare time in some way or reading about it. Look for a consistent interest. If you find it, you may have found your river. There are those of us who seem to be able to do with equal facility and with equal interest and enjoyment many things. Now many will ask, well, why set goals at all? Why not just take things as they come and do your best with what you've been given to do? A goal gives a picture to the human subconscious. Everyone has goals, whether he or she will admit it or not. Whatever you want to bring about in your life represents a goal. Wants are goals. Goals give us the drive and energy we need to remain on the track long enough for their accomplishment. Like the captain of the ship about to leave port, we should be able to tell anyone our next port of call, and perhaps the one after that. If you've done much traveling at sea, you were perhaps surprised in the beginning by how slowly most large ships seem to move through the water. A ship pulling away from the dock and heading for a distant port at 20 knots may seem painfully slow indeed. But the ship moves steadily, 24 hours a day, always on course. And soon we're in the harbor with mission accomplished. Now, after refueling, a new port of call must be determined. People with goals on which they've set their hearts and minds are always moving toward those goals. Even while we sleep, our deep minds are apparently working on the project. It's interesting and often quite astonishing how people with goals tend to live longer than people without them. It's as though they can extend their lives simply because they have something to do. It must be the interest that lends vitality and energy to their lives. The journey is better than the end, because the journey is life and experience. It puts us in the way of new interests and the most astonishing synchronicity. We say, I have an idea. What is that? It's surely more than a neurochemical electrical response, although it's that too. An idea is the bringing together of known increments to provide a new result. All information of a positive kind has value when we're formulating ideas. When we set an important goal for ourselves, we present to our mind a problem to be solved, a challenge to be successfully fulfilled. Instantly, the mind goes to work to find the information we need to turn that idea into reality. More often than not, we get in our own way by doubting the suggestions that filter into our consciousness, only to discover later that they would have been marvelous shortcuts and simplifications of the process if we'd only heeded them. The idea has become real in our lives, even if it takes 3 years to pay for it. We become what we think about, but the thinking is up to us. And the degree to which people regularly underestimate their capacity for accomplishment is immeasurable. When it comes to setting goals for ourselves, we tend to play things outrageously safe and thus remain within limits embarrassingly small. Good ideas are wondrous, delightful, magical things. The fact is, there's no such thing as security as long as we're alive. If we're looking for security during our lifetimes, we're looking for something that simply cannot be guaranteed. Insecurity is our natural state. It's not the chimera, the fire-breathing, multi-legged, and clawed monstrosity we think it is. A good idea is an idea that results in a change that is beneficial. And good ideas come in all shapes and sizes. A good idea means change. Don't ever say, "I'd like to get to the point where I can start taking things easy." After you die, you can take it easy. We're the only creatures with the power to create our own worlds within the world in which we find ourselves. An awesome power, indeed. That's why ideas are the greatest things on earth, for it's ideas that shape our lives. Thank you.